Hello everyone. I'd like to welcome everyone to our second to last Arts and Science Research Talk of the year. Before I go any further, I should do the FOIP announcement and remind everyone that this session is being recorded so that people will be able to access it from the Research Center site later on. So I'd like to welcome Veena Chirvangadam of the Center for Language and Literature. I asked for the quick cliff notes on her career so I could give you a brief bio before we began the session, and she tells me she's done her PhD at the University of Manitoba in 20th century French literature, and she joined the Center for Language and Literature in 2003, where she teaches French language and literature. Her topic today, and you'll have to forgive all of you language and lit folks that I don't speak French, so I will not pronounce the title correctly, but Evaluating La Francophonie, Myths and Realities. So I would like to turn the session over to Veena now.
Can you hear me? Is it loud enough? Yes? Okay, so I thank you very much for being here on a Friday afternoon. I'm sure you would probably prefer to be somewhere else. But anyway, I'll try to entertain you as much as I can. All right. So the topic then of my talk is Evaluating La Francophonie, Myths and Realities. Okay. And I have to read it because I have a lot of things to say. Some of the most exciting and stimulating literature to appear during the last few decades has been written by men and women living in and originating from former British colonies, people like most of us know, Michael Ndadji, Rahinton Mistry, Vasanji, Hanif Qureshi, etc. What is true of the English-speaking world is also true of the French-speaking world. For recently, some of the most prestigious literary prizes have been awarded to French writers born outside metropolitan France. Some of the most well-known are... We need the next slide. We're trying to get the next slide.
Yes.
Thank you. Some of the most well-known, then, you have their names here. They're the Moroccan writer Tahar Ben Jelloun, who won the Goncourt, which is France's highest literary award, for his novel La Nuit Sacrée in 87, and who was made Grand Officer of the Légion d'Honneur in February 2008 by Sarkozy himself. The Martinican author Patrick Chamoiseau, whose novel Texaco was also awarded the Prix Goncourt in 1992. The Lebanese writer Amin Malouf, whose novel Le Rocher de Tanios also received the Goncourt in 1993. The Algerian novelist Achia Djebbar, the first writer from the Maghreb to be elected to the Académie Française in 2005. The Indo-Mauritian writer Ananda Devi, who received the Prix des Cinq Continents in 2006, etc. And finally, the Franco-Mauritian writer Jean-Marie Le Clézio, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2008. Other winners have been, next slide. Yeah, again, I'm going to go through the names quickly. Again, you may or may not know them. Alain Mabankou from Congo-Brazzaville, who received the Prix Renaudot, another prestigious French literary award. Nancy Houston from Alberta, who received the Prix Femina for her novel Ligne de Faille in 2006. Russia's Andrei Makine, who won the Goncourt for his novel Le Testament Français in 1995. And the New York writer, Jonathan Little, who won the Goncourt for his French novel Les Bienveillantes in 2007. It is an undeniable fact, then, that foreign-born writers writing in French are winning France's major literary awards. This was so self-evident that on Friday, March 16, 2007, a manifesto appeared in the French newspaper Le Monde, promoting what it called une littérature monde en français, world literature in French. Because according to the signatories of the manifesto, the notion of francophonie, which was normally reserved to describe writers from outside metropolitan France, especially from the ex-colonies and from Canada, did not apply anymore, for it was vague, racist, and in any case, out of date. There were 44 signatories in all in this manifesto, some of whom are among veteran advocates of such writing. So we have their names here. But what was very interesting was the fact that several prominent French writers, among them Éric Orsenard, who I thought I had highlighted it, it doesn't matter, who was a prolific French writer, a recipient of many literary awards, and also a member of the elite Académie Française, as well as the esteemed Jean-Marie Le Clézio, who received the 2008 Prize for Literature, also signed the manifesto. So their endorsement implied their recognition that French literature had been dormant and static for too long, that it had been absorbed with the form of the text, the structure of the narrative technique, rather than with the narrative itself. This obsession with form had in fact reinforced the view in France that colorful francophone writing emanating from exotic locales and set in these locales were somewhat inferior to the more, shall we say, in quotes, intellectual French fiction from France, and that therefore they did not deserve the same treatment as those written by French authors. And to quote a well-known Vietnamese writer, French Vietnamese, who also signed the manifesto, and her name is Anna Moy, and I quote, she says, "My novels written in French and published by Gallimard are placed in bookshops in the Vietnamese literature section." End of quote. They argued then that the term francophone had outlived its usefulness, that it should be discarded in favor of littérature monde en français, world literature in French. They pointed out that literature written in French, as I said, was shifting away from literature engendered by what they call la clique parisienne, the Parisian clique, and was concentrating to a more imaginative version produced by writers outside of France. And the main cause for the rising popularity of these writers, they claimed, was the current sterility of fiction produced within what they call l'Hexagone. L'Hexagone is another word used for France. They argued, therefore, that the title of francophone literature reserved for writers outside of France should be eliminated because these very writers had been treated for far too long by the French literary establishment as second-class citizens. And as they so aptly put it, and I quote, "No one speaks francophone. No one writes francophone. A francophonie is the light of a dead star." They said it in French, but I just translated it. Go a bit back. Manifesto. The one that is before that. You can leave it on that. It's okay. Leave it there. Yeah.
That's fine.
So they also decried the implication that of colonialism, racism, which was inherent in the term. But for this to happen, they argued, French literature must be freed from what they called its exclusive pact with France. End of quote. And as an example worth following, they showed how literature in English had been enriched, energized by Commonwealth and foreign writers such as Naipaul, Gordimer, Salman Rushdie, Coetzee, Arundhati Roy, Kiran Desai, etc. But Nicolas Sarkozy, who was then the conservative French presidential candidate, retorted in an article in the French newspaper Figaro, which is more right-leaning, that, I quote, "Francophonie is not dead and should not be discarded," end of quote. And he added in an optimistic fashion that the prestige of the French language was intact. This article was soon followed by the publication of a book entitled Pour une littérature monde, published by Gallimard, here, which Audrey has a copy and she very kindly brought it, so I'll show it to you. It does exist. Here it is, but there's a copy there. Well, outside the French-speaking world, especially in North America, here too, such a debate might seem bizarre. even perplexing. But in France, this is a very serious matter, because not many other nations are more identified with the language than the French. They watch over how it is written, how it is pronounced, how it is spoken, and consider it an expression of the French thought, French culture, French psyche. Hence the existence of the Académie Française. What is clear from all this is that the word francophonie has now become a politically charged concept. And in order to understand this polemic, perhaps it would be wise for us to begin at the beginning and to see how this state of affairs came into being. For that, we have to look at the birth of the French language itself, follow its evolution over the years to modern-day France. So this will allow us to get a glimpse into the psyche of the French people. I think we need the next slide. Oh, that's fine. We leave it. That's fine, too. That's fine. So French started to replace Latin as the official language of France in the 9th century with what is known as the Serment de Strasbourg. It was half French, half Latin, vulgar Latin at that time. And it emerged as a national language. During the 13th century, French became the official language of France. And by the middle of the 14th century, it was the most widely spoken language in Europe. In 1539, the person who was king then, François Ier, passed an important decree that stipulated that all French administrative documents should now exist in French. In the 17th century, in 1635, under the reign of Louis XIV, the Académie Française was founded, the aim of which was, and still is today, to moderate and regulate the French language, again, as I said, French grammar, spelling, literature, etc. From then to the 19th century, when France was the leading European power, French language flourished and began to be spoken throughout the world. France, and in particular Paris, played an important role as the center of high culture, of arts, first in Europe, and from the 19th century onwards, worldwide. And from the late 19th century, I think France has played an important role in modern art, in cinema, in fashion, cuisine also. The reign of François Ier was also a period of French mercantilist activity in the world, although France was not really committed to overseas expansion as a strategic political doctrine at that time. Yet there were French vessels French explorers and traders who did cross the North and Mid-Atlantic Ocean, as well as the Indian Ocean, and traveled even beyond. This period of seafaring activity lasted 3 centuries, resulted in French trading posts, forts, storage, depots, and some form of elementary colonial settlement being established throughout the world and transporting the French language there. In the 17th century, then, they established, or they set up, if you want, Martinique, Guadeloupe, Cayenne, Louisiana, Saint-Domingue, which is now known as Haiti, and they were established by the French. And, of course, the slave trade from Africa provided the workforce, in the plantations of these places. In the 17th and 18th centuries, France became involved in international trade. Therefore, a number of trading posts were established in a few islands of the Indian Ocean, such as L'Île Bourbon, which is now known as L'Île de la Réunion, in 1638, Madagascar, I've got the dates there, in various comptoirs in India, at Pondicherry and Chandernagore, and when the Dutch withdrew in 1715 in Ile de France, which is today Mauritius. Initial trading contacts were also made with Vietnam and Siam in the 1880s. Again, French traveled to these parts of the world as well. In post-revolutionary France, the country was interested then in nation building. And one of the ways of doing this was by means of the French language and French culture. Okay, in the 19th century, however, France conducted an aggressive wave of overseas expansion, which started with the military expansions of Algiers in 1830. and paved the way for a civilian settlement and colonization. Next slide, please. Okay, all right, that's fine.
Yeah, that's
so they colonized Senegal, Indochina, Nouvelle Calédonie, French Polynesia, Tahiti, Equatorial Africa, Tunisia, Madagascar, and France also tightened its hold over older colonies of the Caribbean and the Indian Ocean, and sent expeditions to the Congo and the Sudan. So now, to administer these territories, they put in place a centralized infrastructure. And to justify its colonial presence and practice in these territories, France did put forward the idea of the superior European cultures who owed it to the, and I quote, less developed people in the colonies, end of quote, to bring to them the benefits of French civilization. French language was the key through which this project could be achieved. So schools were built, which became the vessel through which elite members of the inhabitants could be assimilated to the French language, French culture, and French values. And during this phase, there was a concerted effort to suppress indigenous cultures and languages and replace them with culture and language of the French colonizers. The result today is that French language is spoken by approximately, it depends, the number changes from 150 to 200 million people across the five continents. I don't know which one is true here, but anyway, it's a lot of people. Either as a native tongue, a language of instruction, the language of government, or the language of business. It is obviously the official language of France, one of the official languages of Canada, and the language of 17 other countries in Europe and in the world. But unfortunately for France, English is now replacing it in diplomatic matters and as the international language of communication. French is also being challenged by globalization, which is becoming an irreversible reality. And yet France holds on to values that are most dear to its heart. And with the present president at the helm, some in France are not turning towards the future, but are hankering after the good old days when France was far more powerful than it is today. Okay, so the prestige of the French language is being eroded by English worldwide. Even in former French colonies like Vietnam, Cambodia, Congo, Chad, French has lost ground to both native languages and English. In fact, maybe you heard about it. In 2006, Jacques Chirac, who was then president of France, walked out of an EU summit after a French business leader abandoned his mother tongue and spoke in English. And he said, "We fight for our language," said Chirac. And he said, after the French walkout, when the man who spoke English, his name was Ernest Antoine Sillière, the French head of the European employers group UNIS, addressed the summit, as I said, in the language of business. So Monsieur Chirac added, and I quote, he said it in French, but I've translated it, "I was profoundly shocked to see a Frenchman express himself in English at the table," end of quote. So the walkout provided a vivid illustration of French sensitivity about the decline of the language, which used to dominate the EU. English has now overtaken French in Brussels after the arrival of Sweden, Finland, etc. in 95, and the expansion of the EU to the Eastern Europe nations, 2004. Also, with the internet fast turning English into the world's first language, Monsieur Chirac insisted that he would continue to promote French, which is spoken as a mother tongue by millions of people. French is therefore relying more and more on other French-speaking countries, such as us, Canada, but the French Canada, and ancient colonies of France to spread the word, the French word, that is. Yet, at the same time, it relegates these ancient colonies, and Canada too, by the way, or rather their versions of French, to an inferior status. Or if you wish, they use the word subalterne. So they confer this status by referring to them not as French speakers, but as Francophone speakers. In fact, the French Academy, which controls the French language, as I've mentioned, refuses words that are accepted in Belgium or Quebec, or words from African contexts. For example, the Academy has refused a very interesting verb, an African verb, girafer, which means to giraffe. Do you know what it means? It means, it refers to a tall student who is copying the work of another student who's tall, so he's looking over the shoulder. So it's used girafer, and the French just don't like that word. I think it's very colorful. Yeah, but I like it, to giraffe. So generally speaking then, stating that you speak French is to lay claim to a particular identity, but to say that you are Francophone is to locate yourself within a culture that is not yours. Francophone can thus be viewed as a status of incompletion, of being, in quotes, less than, of belonging to a lower status, ultimately to one of exclusion rather than inclusion. In usage, the word francophone can be seen as extending the scope of the word French and France. It is common to hear the word French and France and the francophone world, or to do what I've done myself when I'm designing French lit courses here. I call it French and francophone literature. But putting these two words together seems to promote a shared common ground where francophone can be seen as supplementing the word French, and where France, though, functions as the key reference point, and francophone as an extension of it. So how did the word francophone or francophonie come into being? Linguistically, I've checked in the dictionary, it is derived from Latin from the word francus, who were members of the Frankish tribes who invaded Gaul in the 5th and 6th centuries AD, and from the Greek word phoné, meaning sound, or voice. So in this context, the word francophone would seem to mean French-speaking, in the same way that anglophone would designate English speaker. But yet, I would argue that the word anglophone is somewhat of a neutral linguistic term, describing speakers of English in general, whereas the word francophone is loaded with a vast range of ideological and political meanings, which carries meanings and connotations that go far beyond its semantic meaning. So I'd like to explain what I mean here. When we use the adjective French in French culture or French literature, we are normally referring to the culture and literature of metropolitan France, which may include the reign of Charlemagne, Louis XIV, Napoleon Bonaparte. We may also be referring to Versailles, to Molière, Voltaire, Hugo, Baudelaire, Camus, to name but a few authors of the traditional French canon. But when we use the word francophone, we are investing it with many meanings, one of which is the presence of otherness. So the adjective francophone in francophone literature, therefore, can be viewed as a term which describes everything that is written in French that is not from metropolitan France and is thus somewhat of an inferior quality. Not that I believe it, but this is the implication. The word francophone was first coined by the geographer Honorisme Reclus, is handsome member? That's him. In the second half of the 19th century, to name the places where people speak French in a linguistic and in a linguistic group, also a geographical group. So he argued that the prestige of France was intrinsically linked to the French language itself. And he advanced the idea that France's destiny was to map the globe through the French language and to export it to the far-flung corners of the globe. So from its earliest uses then, the word francophone was associated with the politics of nation building. But in the latter part of the 19th century, 1880, the word francophone was used to invoke the idea, again in quotes, of the more advanced nations such as France, which had a duty to participate in what it called, in quotes, its mission civilisatrice, civilizing mission. Another argument put forward to justify France's role in civilizing its colonies was its belief in the doctrine of progress, in social Darwinism, in anthropology, which was just advancing thoughts of primitive races who fell far below in the line of progress to the advanced French. French was therefore used as a tool of progress, or perhaps of subjection. Okay. But as has been recognized by the Kenyan novelist and theorist of postcolonial literature, Ngugi Wa Thiong, I quote, he says, "The domination of a people's language by the languages of the colonizing nations was crucial to the domination of the mental universe of the colonized." End of quotation. And one of the primary tasks of this mission civilisatrice, then, saw France's attempt to turn its colonial subject into French people. Because the French really believed that if properly taught or trained, French values and French language, people from the colonies, such as Algeria, Vietnam, would evolve and become French. There was also a moral component to the mission civilisatrice in that some French held it was their duty as a more enlightened advanced race to elevate the ignorant masses of the non-Western world. And France saw itself in essence as exporting the very material in fulfillment of this mission civilisatrice. Now let us not just blame the French for this way of thinking, because there was of course a corresponding belief that circulated in Europe, Victorian England too, particularly around 1800s. At the time it was referred to, probably you've all heard it, I'll quote it anyway, it was called the white man's burden. Heard of it? It was a popular concept that stated it was the responsibility of Europeans to bring proper European civilization to the nations that did not have it. Kipling argued that the white race had an obligation to, I quote, save the savages, who to him, according to him, were, I quote, half devil and half child, end of quote. So the underlying thought was that Europeans, the French, had got it so right. It was their duty to bring everyone in the world up as close as the European standards as possible. There were many illustrations. This is one of them that I saw online, which is ridiculous, but it illustrates that idea. So implicit within this argument, then, was the notion of the superiority of the French culture, of the Europe, of the French language, of the French institution. In short, a Eurocentric view of the world. The irony is, of course, that many of the individual nations of Europe that did use this argument of mission civilisatrice for their expansionist policies would, within a decade, be fighting each other in the Great War of 1914-1918. What is also interesting is that the French were so successful at promoting the French language that eventually it was employed by opponents of colonial rule when decolonization struggles began to gather steam in the latter part of the 20th century. And the French that had been used to assimilate populations to a French way of viewing the world, or the French language, sorry, was used by those who rejected that order to win independence. So after many French colonies gained their independence in the 1960s, they didn't abandon French. They began a series of initiatives to promote the concept of francophonie, whose aim then was to bind agreements between France and the ex-colonies. It would eventually become the framework of la francophonie and the Organisation Internationale de la Francophonie, International Organization of Francophonie. And this organization started, I think, in 1970 as a kind of post-independence club, if you wish, of French-speaking countries. It was initiated by Léopold Senghor from Senegal, and it's okay. Okay, and Habib Bourguiba, all right, of Tunisia, the very people who had fought for the independence of their own countries. Today, this organization has its own flag. There's the flag of la Francophonie. It has 55 member states and governments, and Canada is part of it too, although it was never really colonized that way, and 13 observers. So as I said, among the other members of the organization, there's Bulgaria, Canada, and Egypt. They are full members. And La Francophonie is present on five continents. And implicit in it is the notion of faith in the universal, eternal value of French culture, which has been the central argument of the Mission Civilisatrice in the first place. It promotes a view of the world in which French interests and prestige are protected and advanced. Central also to its belief is the argument that France is the touchstone of civilized contacts within the movement. While some may find this version of Francophonie understandable, others do not, given the neo-colonial spirit which is associated with this argument. Today, official Francophonie promotes the French language, training, higher education, research, peace, democracy, and human rights. There is also Jeux de la Francophonie, just like Commonwealth Games, etc. And France is the main financial backer and provides two-thirds of the funds. So France still controls the main funds of Francophonie. And in the scheme of things, the idea that France knows best, that it has solutions for the ex-colonies, is there. And France is seen as the marker of the language, French, of French culture, of French, from which other versions of Francophonie or Francophone have derived. It can be seen as France looking outwards, if you wish, embracing the Francophone world within a unifying vision. It can also be viewed as an opposition or a way of marking a contrast between metropolitan France, French, and other speakers of French, of reducing the Francophone speakers to an inferior status, occupying normally an inferior position with regard to metropolitan French speakers. So these two contrasting usages of the word francophone show the two different ways of conceptualizing francophone. The Littérature Monde manifesto that I mentioned at the very beginning, the version presents itself as an alternative to metropolitan France and offers different variants of the language, different accounts of events, which originate from different cultural and geographical contexts. So it challenges the narrative discourses by which metropolitan French cultural life legitimates itself as the original authority. So these two incompatible notions reveal the tension that exists between the center, metropolitan France, la métropole, and the periphery, the Francophone world, and reveal the opposition separating us, that means France, I don't consider myself part of it, and them, the others. Today we can view Francophonie in two ways then. Firstly, as a unified vision emanating outwards from metropolitan France to the periphery, whose aim is to defend, to promote, to maintain French everywhere. It can be seen as respecting the individualized identity of the Francophone other. But for this to happen, it must also take into account the huge diversity of Francophone spaces, avoid any imperial homogenization as one size fits all. Because the political, ethnic, cultural reality in Senegal, for example, is not the same as the reality in Vietnam or Tunisia, Algeria, for example. Alternatively, it can be seen as a cultural practice, especially in a literary sense, conveying a subalterne status on Francophone writers as seeking to extend its concept of French over them. So these two visions of the meaning of the word Francophonie serve to highlight the position of the speaker in relation to the word's meaning, what it means. So when the manifesto came out, Abdou Diouf, who was then Secretary General of La Francophonie, I think he still is, I'm not sure, he defended La Francophonie and wrote in response that, and I quote, "The French language does not belong to the French. It belongs to all those who have chosen to learn it, to use it, to enrich it with the accents of their culture, their imagination, and their talent." End of quotation, he said. Thus, he lamented the manifesto's efforts to bury La Francophonie. Today, in contemporary academic life in France, there is a general mistrust, you know, of any kind of post-colonial theory, Littérature Monde being one of them, which they see as an Anglo-Saxon invention. Despite the fact that many writers, most of them who contributed to it, are French or Francophones. As one can expect, there are many writers outside France who have written and are writing and publishing in French and in France. Many of them are from Canada and the Maghreb, from sub-Saharan Africa, from the Middle East, the Caribbean, and the Indian Ocean. But in this part of my talk, I shall introduce one of these writers to you who hails from l'île Maurice, Mauritius. Do you know why? Because I'm from there. Who has also achieved literary recognition in France. She has come to occupy a unique position in the field of littérature monde. There she is. Her name is Ananda Devi. I chose to talk about her because, as I said, she's from Mauritius, the country where I come from, although I was born there, but I went to live in England afterwards. She was born on the 25th of March, 1957. She's an ethnologist by training, obtained her doctorate in social anthropology at the University of London, England. She speaks many languages, French, English, Hindi, Telugu, which is an Indian language in the southern part of India, and Mauritian, which is the local dialect. And she bridges admirably the cultures of the East and the West. She has lived in France for more than two decades, was born into a Hindu family like mine, moved from India to Mauritius three generations ago. Her childhood was multifaceted, much like the island of Mauritius, to which she accredits her motivation to write. She is the author of 10 novels, all written in French, and I have some of them here, a collection of poems, and several short stories. She wrote her first novel, L'Arbre Fouet, Under the Willow Tree, at the age of 12, and began to make her mark in Mauritian literature when she won, at the age of 15, a prize, a short story, a competition organized by Radio France Internationale, the French National Broadcasting Corporation. Her story was subsequently broadcast on French radio and published in an anthology. It was the beginning of a long career, more than 30 years, during which she progressively has become a more prominent figure in French language literature from the Indian Ocean and sought the world over. Her novels are currently being translated into several languages, English, Dutch, Spanish, Hindi. She translates some of her novels into English herself. So her novels provide an ample canvas where she constructs the multifaceted Mauritius, but she goes beyond the postcard paradis exotique description of Mauritius, remains connected, although she remains connected to the vibrant diversity of a country's history and culture. She opens up her readership not only to Mauritians, but to the world. She is the subject of numerous conferences on French postcolonial writing, and I did have the privilege of meeting her at a conference on French literature, the Congrès International d'Études Francophones, that I attended in Cayenne, in French Guiana, in July 2007, where she was the guest speaker, and where I was presenting a paper on a French writer, Romain Gary. Central to her work, then, are questions of identity, exclusion, deviance, solitude, suffering. She treats themes that move between the specific and the universal, raises feminist, political, multicultural, and nationalistic questions. And perhaps, as has been suggested by certain critics, although I don't see that myself, the fractures in identity that follow the aftermath of colonization or decolonization. Her works add another dimension to the French language, and it enriches it with layers of cultural, linguistic, and ethnic pluralities that the island of Mauritius is known for. And the appeal to Eastern mysticism and Indian mythology are undeniable in her earlier works, especially in one of her novels, which is called, I have it here, Le Voile de Draupadi. So Draupadi is the name of a heroic princess of the Hindu epic poem, the Mahabharata, and who was firm and steadfast, etc. So in the early writing, there's that, but not in the later ones. Although there is a unity that comes from her experience of life in Mauritius, and her works express the diversity and cultures inhabiting her home country, they are universal in scope. She said at the conference that I attended, and I quote, she said it in French, I'll say it in French and then I'll translate it. She said, "J'essaie d'atteindre l'universel à travers le particulier," which means, I try to reach the universal through the individuals I depict in my stories. End of quotation. So the works do reflect the sensibilities of a woman of East Indian origin, and the themes and treatment of her novels arise from social and political situations in the country. In another novel that she wrote, it's called Pagli. It's a Hindu word which is used in Mauritius, which means mad woman. She tells the story of a woman of Indian origin who is unhappy in her marriage, but her family confines her to a room, brands her Pagli, mad, when she has an affair with a Creole fisherman, a Creole man by the name of Zil, who belongs to an inferior socio-economic and cultural group in Mauritius, and is therefore considered an outcast. She's now published by the prestigious Gallimard Publishing House, Gallimard, the most prestigious in France, sorry. And she has won several international prizes, the most recent being Eve de Cédicombre. I have it here too, in case you're interested. In fact, she signed it for me when I saw her. There it is. That's one of them. It is set in an urban setting, the capital city of Mauritius, but it evokes many other inner cities of France. In it, she works the themes of sexual abuse, rape, murder, male brutality. It centers on the narratives of four adolescents, providing four different perspectives leading to the murder of one of them. Her latest novel is entitled, it is French, in French you say Indian Tango, although she uses the English word there, again she's playing with words, English, French, etc. This one is set in New Delhi and traces the parallel paths of two characters, a 50-year-old woman reaching menopause who sees, and I quote, who sees all too well, all too clearly the straight line leading to the end of her femininity. Of course, it's in French. It's been translated. And the other, a writer, perhaps Ananda Devi herself, who comes to India to find answers to an innate despair. This was in quote. So their path in the city is like a dance towards and away from each other, a tango of desire, sensuality, with a startling conclusion. I have the book here too, and it's in French. So Ananda Devi is sensitive to the overlap of identities and languages. She uses French, English, Hindi, Mauritian words, etc., all of which are spoken and written in Mauritius. Her characters come from all fabric of Mauritian life or Indian life or any life, but she depicts the universal. She perceives the human characters that clash with one another and destroy one another in the insular space of Mauritius. But it is recreated, which is a microcosm of the world. But her characters are trapped by forces of society, prejudice, cruelty, etc. But in its splendor and diversity, Mauritius is at the heart of her work, as I've said. But she demystifies the romantic vision of Mauritius as the island of paradise that everyone thinks it is. She places the plight of the marginalized in the foreground and shows that despite the economic boom of the 80s and the 90s in Mauritius, perhaps because of it, behind the veneer of harmony, the island suffers many prejudices. Cleavages do exist within the society, and Mauritius has been exposed to the darker forces of globalization. She says, I quote, "I talk about those left behind. It is not a tropical paradise," end of quote. Living outside Mauritius has not removed her from her country, because she says, since I wrote a lot about it, I feel I am living there. And this novel, one of the novels, has received very high acclaim in France. Commenting on her work, Véronique Bragard, who's writing a book, says, and I state the following, and I'll just quote it, "The work of Ananda Devi is both tragic and poetic. Haunted by the issues of exclusion, of otherness, of deviance and suffering, denounces the stifling climate of any society. It stands against any form of rejection and offers a genuine commitment for the recognition of otherness. On a final note, I've nearly finished. When non-metropolitan writers have their work published in France, there is a neat way of packaging the writer as exotic, of establishing a link between geography and ethnicity. In 2000, Gallimard launched a series dedicated solely to the what it called the writings from the Black Continent. Okay, and it called it Continent Noir and its diaspora. And anyone else who writes and who is not white, and called it Continent Noir. This has been criticized as an essentially divisive strategy. It was seen as a way to ghettoize literature coming from this part of the world and of creating an opposition again between French and Francophone literature. It's interesting to note that when Anoda Devi first published a work by Gallimard, the most prestigious publishing house, the first two appeared in the series Continent Noir, were packaged as a manifestation of African essence, although she's not an African. In 2006, after staying in the ghetto of the Continent Noir, it is because it is ghettoized, her novel Eve et ses décombres and Indian Tango were published in what is called the Collection Blanche, the white collection. Yeah, a move that seems to mark Gallimard's recognition of her literary worth and her acceptance into the elite club of the French literature, of white French literature. Suddenly she became, and they referred to her as, La Blanche. This means that she has now become part of mainstream French literature, moving from the margin to the center, no longer exotic, but French, and also Blanche.
White.
Thank you. And this is a bibliography of her work. Thank you very much for being here and for listening to my ramblings. Thank you. Merci.
Thank you very much for an interesting and enlightened discussion. They sound like lovely works, but unfortunately, if I read them, they'll have to be in translation. I invite questions from the audience here, if anyone has questions. Remember to turn on your mic.
Before you ask questions, this is just the beginning of a research that I'm doing on Anoda Devi and another woman writer from Mauritius. I just came across them accidentally because I, like most people who have studied literature, I was concentrating on the French canon. Did not even know about them until about 2 or 3 years ago. It's only 2 or 3 years ago that I became aware of this. And now I'm going on sabbatical next year and I'm going to devote my time, my whole year, to investigating this literature. It is very beautiful. It is well written, but again, as I said, it uses a lot of French words, English words, Mauritian words, etc. Okay, so questions? I'm all ears. Rory.
By Mauritian, you mean what, Creole or Bolivari or which language?
It's a little bit a combination of two. It's a Creole, but the Creole is based mainly on French. The words are French. It's very, very close to French, but the structure is a bit different. But then realize that French comes from Latin. It was exactly the same, had the same status at the beginning. And a bit of Bhojpuri. But Bhojpuri, that's more Hindi, right? Yeah. So, yeah. So she does have a few words of, she doesn't really use Creole, she uses more Bhojpuri or Hindi and English in her writings.
Want to go in?
So I'm wondering, now that she's accepted and embraced by the center, what is the response to her Creolization, the fact that she uses all these, this contaminated French, basically?
Her style is very poetic. She has a beautiful style. Mm-hmm. The style is really, really beautiful. I think one of the things that they like is the way she writes. Mm-hmm. But she does use a few, and the people she writes about are not mainstream French people, you see. Her characters are in Mauritius. But, as I've said, she says, although they are in Mauritius, they're really universal. I sent them in Mauritius, but they could be anywhere. And the style, and she uses the most elegant French style that one can come across. And I think that's what they embrace.
So it's not like a joual, and it's
no,
it's
absolutely
it's
not.
Pure French.
It's pure French.
She sprinkles
yes.
throughout the
yes.
other.
She no, no. Yeah, it's, okay. it's pure French. It's very standard, mm-hmm. very elegant French. Yes, okay. It's a little bit like Gabrielle Roy writing, you know, her French from Manitoba. You know, her French is very poetic. She's that kind of French. Yes, it's like poetry. She writes poetry too, but it's not joual, not at all. Anyone who knows French would understand what she's saying. But the themes might be different because she takes themes from Indian mythology. So that might be a bit different. Yeah. It's not from the Bible. It's not Judeo-Christian. No. Joe?
Vina, I was interested in what you were talking about in terms of Francophone and La Francophonie. And I was thinking, Is there a parallel situation in terms of English literature or, you know, world literature in English? And there isn't really that kind of argument as far as I can see. But the other European countries have that attitude. Like, for example, Italy is very snobbish about writers from outside of Italy that write in Italian. I think the difference between the English and the French attitude towards this is not just that maybe the democratic tradition in the UK is more open to the colonies and colonials, but I think there's also the fact that in France is the dominant country of French, right? Whereas you can no longer say that the British Isles is the dominant country of English because you have American and Australia and Canada. So you have other major colonies that can no longer tolerate having one standard.
Yeah.
English. So that's, whereas France doesn't have any, there's no other competitor.
I was thinking about that too. But also, I think what I tried to demonstrate is that the French have always had this identity with the language. They always have. And they have the Académie Française, which does not exist in English. In English, people speak it, well, write it even, you know, this double split infinitive and all that business. It's become standard now. But in French, that would not happen, you know. In standard French, you couldn't get away with this kind of structure. So there is that. There is that idea that French, you cannot fool around with it. It has its structure. It's very precise. And you don't play with this. That's why they don't like the French that comes out of Quebec, for example. Now, all these ex-colonies, those who write, they write very well. They've learned it very well. They write exactly the way the French write. But it's just the things they write about, the locales are exotic, are different. And that was that's why it was, in a way, ghettoized. It's not that they couldn't write it. The structure, the grammar, the vocabulary, everything was fine, was very well written. It's just the ideas they were presenting were different, whereas in Joual, it's a complete. I must admit, I don't understand Joual myself. You know, I don't. There are some regional versions of French in Canada that I don't understand. So what I'm saying, French in Canada has evolved very differently and is written differently too. We're not talking about Pierre Trudeau or people like that, but generally, people speak it differently, and they're not too particular about the way they write it either sometimes. Whereas these ex-colonies, those who do write, they write it well. It's the same, you know, how should I say, Vasanji or Mistry writes English very well. They're from Mumbai, right? Not Vasanji, but Mistry. They learned it in India, but they learned it properly. They write it well. So these people, like Ananda Devi, she writes French very well too. So she's not playing around with the syntax. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, with the syntax, the way the sentence is structured. She's just throwing in some words, some ideas that are different.
Oh, Audrey, yes. Just in the same vein, so you'd say that this new generation of writers are the ones that are known now, like Ananda Devi. They've moved away from the whole sort of créolité.
Well, they never wrote in créole. They never really wrote in créole, you see. That was when the Caribbean
Yes, I know.
I
was just thinking of the soul searching of people like Patrick Chamoiseau and Raphael Confiant.
Yes.
They obviously had to publish in French if
yes.
you want to sell your books.
Yes.
You need to publish in French, but there was this feeling of betrayal well, and
yes.
even accusations that
yes.
they were writing in French
yes.
And not Creole.
No, I think in Mauritius, people are very proud of her. They don't think that she's betrayed anyone. They're very happy that she is recognized, certainly. Certainly, yes.
Is it their aspiration to move from
no.
Noir to Blanche?
No, I don't think so. I don't think they do want that. But to me, I was just mentioning it because I find it ironic. To me, I just said it because it's very... But the Blanche, although the French deny that there is a color connotation in this, they don't... No, honestly. Honestly, it started with Gide. No, it started with Gide. There was absolutely no color connotation then. It started in the... No. It really started, but they have denied that it has anything to do with color. I mean, there's a lot of articles being written about it. I'm reading it now. As I said, I just discovered it recently. But she doesn't care. All she cares about is to be recognized as a writer. I mean, she's an Indian. She's like me. I don't want to be either. I am who I am. I'm Indian. That's it. And I'm neither black nor white. I'm Indian. And she is the same. Yeah. Do you see?
Where does she live now?
She lives in France.
Okay. Was the move from Mauritius to France coinciding with this recognition change?
No.
Be interesting she's, to see.
She's been in France for 25, 30 years.
But she's only white.
No. The last two novels. That was only 2 or 3 years ago. Oh, yes. Oh, she's French now. Well, she doesn't look French, she doesn't act French, she doesn't dress French, but yes. Yeah. Yeah. No.
She writes like a French.
In a way, yes. But she writes about her country. This is it, yeah.
It strikes me that a playful translation of Francophonie would be sounds like French, but isn't really
isn't.
French.
Yes.
Right? And I was thinking, I don't think we talk of an Anglophone literature, do we? We talk about literature in English.
It used to be Commonwealth.
Yeah. We don't talk about Anglophone
literature.
It used
literature. To be Commonwealth literature.
Okay.
What,
yeah.
Didn't it?
Well, Anglophone is just the Canadian.
An Anglophone is anyone who speaks English.
They don't use it in the rest of
English-speaking.
I just wonder about the attitude of why they would even want to be considered French. I've seen people get very insulted when they refer to George Bernard Shaw as an English writer or James Joyce as English writers. They get very upset about that.
No, I don't think she wants to be referred to as French. Are you talking about another...
writer.
Oh, yes, I see. No, but what I was trying to say that for the French, when they say Francophone, It has a connotation of not being as good as the French. You know, it's true. It's very true. The Quebecois accent is ridiculed in France. Did you know that?
Oh, I did.
Yeah. It's ridiculed. It's laughed at. Yeah.
But I guess part of my comment was getting at this difference between the phonic and the written. I mean, you're using, it is the word phonic, which means spoken. And you know, there are maybe some parallels in other civilizations, such as Chinese, which has essentially a single written language, but many spoken dialects.
Mm.
But again, in which one spoken form predominates.
Yes.
But also, I was wondering if you'd reflect upon the global status of French.
Yes,
because
I have.
You know, I was thinking, well, French has been, at least by English people, has been called the language of love.
Mm-hmm.
For many, it's also the language of rationality, if you think of Descartes and Voltaire. So, if you combine love and rationality, you've got a pretty good mix.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's where the idea that it's really the language of true civilization
yes.
comes in. What it's lacking is the language of business, which is where
very
English has established itself.
Very good point.
Right?
Yes.
So, you know, and maybe, you know, in a certain framework, it was precisely because it was not associated with business that it was civilized. Mm. And so, you know, that's a way of looking at the world,
Yes.
So I'm wondering where French is going globally. Where is it positioning itself?
Well, I think it realizes in terms of global, it is very much behind many other Western countries in terms of communication, etc. And I think Sarkozy is trying to bring France up to the level of other Western countries, but there is a reaction in France. The French are not really interested in that. They're more interested in their culture, in their language, in their food, in their art. They want to maintain that identity. And I say that from personal experience. One of my sisters-in-law is very French, Parisienne, very educated woman. And she does not consider these writers, well, not her, but others, as being French. She really thinks they're inferior. She really believes that they are inferior. And she is against globalization, very much so. She sees it, again, as an Anglo-Saxon, you know, plot. No, really. They are entrenched in their culture, the way of seeing the world, but they realize that they have no choice. If they want to move forward with the world, they have to adopt some of the, you know, what other countries are doing, because England really is far ahead in technology, much more so than they are. I know we were there about 2 or 3 years ago, and I needed to get my computer to work, my laptop. There was something missing, and I couldn't find it anywhere in Paris. On Sundays, everything was closed. On Saturdays, they had no idea what I was talking about, and they just were very, very much, well, no, it's true, they're not ahead of the game as far as technology is concerned.
Is this why Derrida is more favored in other parts of the world than in France itself?
Absolutely. They don't like Derrida, they don't like Foucault. You see, the academic world doesn't like them. So that's why they're all in the States. Isn't Said in the States too? Edouard Said, is he still? So they have exported all these thinkers elsewhere, because they don't want them there. So I don't think French language will ever disappear. Of course not. How can it? I mean, it's beautiful. I love it. I mean, I don't want it to disappear. I spent my life learning it. So I do love it. I think it's beautiful. But I know it's going through a very difficult period at the moment. Sorry.
Would it be another way of possibly looking at your thesis here to compare the Oxford English Dictionary with the Larousse, and are there differences in? I mean, we're nowadays the Oxford is very self-promoting when they say we've incorporated this American slang, yes, and we are, you know, mm-hmm, this is the newest word, and it's now accepted into canon of official English.
Mm-hmm.
But does the opposite?
No,
it doesn't do that.
I looked in the Le Robert, Le Petit Robert, the latest edition, which and I looked for the word girafe. It's certainly not there. Mm-hmm. There are many other words that exist in. They are incorporating some Quebecois word now. They do a little bit, but not much. Not as much as the Oxford will embrace other terms, yes. As I said, I'm just starting this project. This is not normally the project that I normally work on. So as I go through it, I'll find, you know, there are many, many other things that I have to investigate, read about, and, you know, get to know. It's just the beginning of a project. Yes.
One other thing, I recently at a conference in Hong Kong of people who write law, and we had some very interesting discussions about bilingual and trilingual drafting. And one of the things Canada has come up with is a new profession, which they call jurilinguists, who are people whose specialty is to try to understand law and write it in two or more languages.
Mm.
And one of the points they were making is that the when they're trying to convey law in common law terms, the English approach to law, they often find that they're struggling for French words because the French civil law does not have the same concepts. So in some cases, they are creating new French words for use in Quebec, of course, primarily.
In Quebec, yes.
For use in Quebec.
Yes, yes.
And they're finding, they recognize that they are artificial words, but they're finding that they are gradually permeating the culture there and becoming everyday accepted words in French legal culture,
yes,
at least, in
yes,
Quebec.
Yes.
So I just thought it.
Yeah. But you know, with the world of computers, more and more there are new words coming, being born, I suppose, being created, as far as the communication world is concerned, especially with the computer. So these words now, the same reality has to be expressed in French. And what is happening that Quebec is coming up with wonderful ideas, and they have translated these words or these terminologies, for example, like email. In French, in France, they use the word mail. They use the English word. But in Quebec, they've come up with the word courriel. Right? Yes. So there are other words like that. And the Quebecois are very, how should I say, creative at translating all these terminologies, especially as far as the computer world is concerned. And France doesn't really know how to deal with that. But now, on the one hand, it admires Quebec for doing this. On the other hand, it doesn't want to incorporate a lot of the words that they come up with. So it's a sort of, it's a very strange situation, you know. On the one hand, love, hate, I don't know if that's the word. But on the one hand, they want to embrace Quebec. On the other, they don't.
Because they're more prone to use English.
Yeah. Yes. They don't. Well, ironically, yes, they do. They do. They don't mind using the word email because they say that word is not going to change the structure of our language. One word here and there is okay. But not writing it properly is not okay. Not knowing syntax is not okay. Not pronouncing it is not okay. Yeah.
Isn't there a kind of at least a paradox between this claim towards universality that's been so strong in France, especially in its relationship to the question of multiculturalism, asserting the way in which we can't have any particular kinds of symbolisms within the school and that kind of thing, and this very particular attachment to the French language.
Yes, there is very particular attachment
to
French.
Is
someone
there? What's this?
Someone is on?
Oh,
Jody wants to ask a question when you're done, Paul.
Okay. How do they, are they aware of that contradiction or that paradox anyway, or and situate themselves somewhere there, at least in terms of the people that are really defending the French language as in its purity? No?
I don't know. Yeah. Sorry, Paul, I can't answer that. Yeah.
Is there someone there? Is that? Manager? Jody?
She's written her question. So she says, Bonjour, Zina. I'm wondering if the works from Francophone authors such are as widely translated into English and other languages as authors from France. If so, how are they received?
Well, hello, Judy. All I can tell you is that the author I talked about, her work is being translated in English. The others, I don't know. I honestly do not know. Perhaps Audrey could answer that. Do you know, Audrey? No, I don't know. I'm sorry. I have to look into that one. Did she hear me, or do I have to type it back?
No, I'm sure she heard you.
Okay.
She's listening.
Okay. All right. Okay. I just heard that Malouf is in English, has been translated. And who else? You don't know? Well, some of them. Some of the very well-known ones, like Malouf. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yes.
Can you repeat that comment for those off-site, Joe?
Malouf's books have been translated into English, he writes about he writes about Muslim and Arabic culture, for example, what's his name? the African, what's the first name of the African novel? Anyway, I have some of the titles. So those books are available in English.
Mm.
Espanol?
Espanol?
Yeah. That's
has
right.
Has Espanol been translated in English? As I said, I don't know. I probably. He's more of a theorist, yeah? Yes. Yes, he would be. He would be. Okay. Well, I think as I was trying to tell you, I was not really into what was called Francophone literature for the longest time until very recently. So there's a lot that I have to learn and read so I can document myself. This is just an introduction. So, sorry? Oh, merci. Okay. Do you have any more questions?
Okay, Audrey. Just one. This is probably going off topic, but I was just wondering if you know anything about the status of the littérature beurre now in French. That is the French writers who are mostly French born of North African descent. Are they received any differently?
Well, about 2 or 3 years ago, I remember going to a conference in Winnipeg. Linguistic circle, and there was someone who was presenting, who was talking about littérature beurre, and I had not heard about it. This is the first time I heard about it, and apparently it's being well received. It's being well received, but is it being published at Gallimard? I can't tell you. I don't know. Because being published by Gallimard is very prestigious. It is the most prestigious. So, Who? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I was just wondering, thinking about the littérature monde and this desire to rejuvenate French literature, which people see as sclérosé.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if there was the same attitude towards the beurre.
The beurre, because they are homegrown, right?
Yes.
They are homegrown, yes. Yes. But I think the beurre literature, doesn't it come mainly from the inner cities? It's the language of the inner cities. It's more, well, I shouldn't perhaps use that analogy. It's not the equivalent of rap, is it? Could you make that kind of analogy? I'm just wondering.
Not quite.
It's
urban, yes. It's
yeah.
Not, well, I don't know. Maybe Sarkozy would think of it as...
Oh, yes, of course.
Kai,
yes. I didn't mean to make that connection, but I'm just wondering if it could be seen as that, because it comes from the inner cities, from the less privileged, you know, and I don't,
so
who
that,
knows?
Just to follow up on that, I was going to ask whether, you know, the concerns you have, the tensions that you've described, are actually present within France as well.
And
so that maybe you could call this type of literature, the inner city, the young people's speech, could it be called an internal francophonie, and that this, you know, is manifesting itself into politics and internal tension within the French state.
Yes.
And because, you know, we see in North America, the latest, I presume, the latest rap phrases are on mainstream television. I mean, it's all just part of the mix. Young people's words.
There's a very good film about that set in France called The Class, which is tracks the life of a teacher with a very disparate student group, all of whom are living in Paris, but they're speaking very many different versions of French.
What is it called? I'm sorry.
The Class.
Entre les murs. Okay. Yes. 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 Thank you. Okay, so you have one more question? No further questions? Shall we say goodbye?
Oh, I just said one more comment.
Oh, sorry.
I was interested to hear you say that postcolonialism is really not very charitably entertained in France as a study, because the main contention of postcolonialism in respect to the English language is that the only way that a new place can come and define itself and understand itself is to create a language that comes out of a place, that specific place and time. So an English that comes from somewhere else is not going to work very well. You have to create your own kind of language.
Yes.
That's Croce's basic argument.
Mm.
So obviously this is
this is not something that the sort of mainstream French would entertain. The language is a construction of place and time as much as it is coming from somewhere else.
Mm.
But English is a creole of French. They created their own worldview.
Well, French is a creole of vulgar Latin.
Yes. Yes.
A language evolves that way.
But the English created their own version of French.
Of French, yes.
On for 400 years, they had French, an English form of French.
Yes.
And it gradually evolved into what we now have, the English language, and we created our own reality. And I would think in colonial worlds, the same process.
Oh, yes. I think.
Going on, but it's
of course,
a mixture of languages.
Of course. But there's always in the world, who's the more powerful economically, etc. Who wants to control the other? So at the moment, and I don't mean to be anti-West or anything like that, but it has had more power for the last 500 years. So a lot of the ideas have been imposed on nations that have had less. So this has happened. So it has had an effect on people's psyche too. So they have thought of themselves as inferior for the longest time. And now they're coming out and saying no. They're creating their own identity, etc.
Well, the church tried to impose Latin, and they kept pushing Latin against all of these Latin languages.
Yes.
And they held on for hundreds of years, but eventually they lost.
Yes.
But let's not forget that the original language of the English common law, at least after 1066, was French. And law French stuck around for quite a long time to the present day, where we still talk in legal textbooks of profitapondres. Profitapondres are a recognized English common law institution.
Mm.
Okay.
So it's a French word.
Yeah. It means the right to go on land and cut the timber. Profitapondre. But also I've been noticing recently on CBC that it appears to be French-Canadian artists now appearing on the English broadcaster, and just recently singing in both languages. It's basically one line will be English and one line will be French, just interchanged like that. And I hadn't heard that before, and that I think that represents a bit of a resurgence of Quebec, at least Quebec artists in Canada. And the way they're doing it is they're just singing in both languages.
There's some truth. I've heard quite a lot of that music, and a lot of it's from Manitoba, and New Brunswick. Some of it is from Quebec, but a lot of it's from Manitoba and New Brunswick, just for information.
I have a question here, and this is sort of an open question because I'm not a literature person, but I'm wondering to what degree the Ibero-American or Latin American Spanish writings from Mexico and South America and whatever, what relationship they play to writings from Spain. Clearly Spain has a National Academy of Language as well, but New World Spanishes are quite diverse and incorporate lots of indigenisms and things like that.
Well, I don't speak Spanish. I've studied a little bit, but I remember when I did take one or two courses, three, whatever, in Spanish, it was made clear to us that there are two types of Spanish. There's the South American, Mexico, and then there's the pure Spanish. It's not that they said that. It's that the people from Spain do believe that their Spanish is superior, same attitude as the French. They do believe that. I don't know. I can't vouch for it because I'm not. I haven't studied it as much as I've studied French. But apparently, there is a similar mentality.
But it must be kind of a language of God, then, right? Because that's the only way you could.
The language of the Pope. That's
you can only.
Because
if you're not tied to place, then you have to be tied to what? To the essence of language, and that seems to be the argument. Because if they say they're not tied to place, and their language is pure, they're talking about the language of the gods. And
well, I think it really is about colonial centers and peripheries, where the more European you were, the higher in the hierarchy, so that in Mexico, for example, you know, you had people who were really seen as Spanish, you know, and criollos and mestizos and whatever, and the more indigenous mixture you got and the more sort of commonplace you got, the lower the status until the Mexican that all happened until the Mexican Revolution, mm-hmm. when they explicitly brought in a culture of mestizaje. But I was also thinking that there are some fabulous Latin American writers of, you know, Nobel laureate level, like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who I think is from Ecuador, you know, and I was just kind of wondering, I can't think of anybody of that stature I've heard of from Spain in a long time.
There were statistics on that recently in the paper when they were announcing the prizes, the Commonwealth Prizes, the Booker Prize, the Nobel Prizes. I think it was the Nobel Literature Prizes. The majority of them in the last 10 years at least have been not from the center. They're from...
Is that why all the Canadian, best Canadian writers come from Saskatchewan, Manitoba?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But talking about
Galore. But also in England, I mean, there's still, I mean, it depends on who you talk to, right?
Yeah.
But there's still this residual snobbery
of
there,
course.
Too. I mean, I'm from England. Most of my family's still there. You know, they confuse you with an American. They think you're the same anyway. What's the difference? And, you know, well, there's culture, and, you know, you have novelists, or, you know, the response to Canadian plays and production in England is, oh, my goodness, you have theater in Canada. And, you know, it's really quite astonishing, the level of ignorance, but... That, you know, there's still this notion that why would I bother to read anything from Canada when we get so much better here? You know, it's still very pervasive.
Yes.
Are we drawing to a close here? Are there any questions or comments from off-site? If so, please let me know and I will yield the microphone to off-site speakers.
Jolene, Jody J. Corey.
There being none, I guess maybe we should adjourn this session and reconvene down the road for beverages, whatever, at the 9th Street Bistro or the bar, whichever is open and we can get a table at. So thank you all very much for attending, and we'll see you next month for a very different talk about wetlands and things like that from Dave Locke.